Lee Zeldin, and the job he's done is great. We had the auto industry in yesterday. They don't want people to fix their car. I said, that's strange. I've never heard of that. They have a thing to, nobody's allowed to fix their car. They gave a man 7 years in jail, actually, because he fixed his own car. So I thought we'd do something about that. But we'll get it all straightened away. Can you believe it? They want a bill that prohibits people from fixing. So if you're mechanically inclined, you know, I grew up, I went to school with some guys who, well, in some cases, horrible students. But they could fix an engine blindfolded. They could take a car apart blindfolded. But they weren't too good at arithmetic and other things. But they were great. And so there's a move on to stop people from fixing their car. I didn't understand it. But we had a great meeting yesterday with the head of General Motors and Roger Penske, head of Ford. We had a great meeting, I think.
Ma, Grandpa's been drinking the bourbon again. What is this dotard talking about? Just rambling on about meetings, about automotive industry people who don't want you to repair your car? What on earth? I've never heard anything like that before.
You don't want people repairing their own vehicles?
No, that's fine. Not for warranty work, though. These are very complicated cars, and we don't think that's safe for many of the repairs on our vehicles. Someone at home like myself could never do it. I mean, I have no problem working on a 73 Bronco. But to work on a brand new Bronco, I need all sorts of specialty tools. That's something that, you know, we would put people's lives at risk.
Oh, right. So as it turns out, there are automotive manufacturers and car company executives who genuinely are against the right of people to repair their own cars, at least for warranty work and other vital things like that. Anyway, that was the CEO of Ford being interviewed by the Detroit Free Press recently in response to Trump's recent comments at the White House about that recent meeting. And boy, is it creating a mess online if you're in the space to know about it. And what space is that? Of course, I'm talking about the right to repair movement. What on earth is right to repair? You may be asking yourself if you've been living under a rock for the past couple of decades. And if so, well, you've come to the right place. I'm glad you slithered out in time for this edition of Solutions Watch so that we can get into the right to repair, why you can't fix your own stuff, and what's being done about it. So here's a handy-dandy explainer from govfacts.org, which explains that a smartphone slips from your hand and the screen shatters, your refrigerator stops cooling, in the middle of harvest season, a high-tech tractor grinds to a halt. A few decades ago, these problems had clear solutions, a trip to a local repair shop where some DIY ingenuity could often solve the issue. Today, the path to a fix is often deliberately complicated. You may discover that only the original manufacturer can perform the repair, that essential parts are unavailable for you, to you or your local mechanic, or that a software lock prevents a perfectly good replacement from working at all. This modern dilemma is at the heart of the right to repair movement, which is a growing coalition of consumers, farmers, small business owners, and advocates fighting to restore the fundamental ability of people to fix the things they own. All right. Simple, straightforward. This is a concept that should resonate with pretty much everyone in the crowd, except for, I guess, billionaires or newly minted trillionaires who have the money to just buy disposable everything and don't care when things break down. For us normal human beings, yes, it is an important thing when something that we rely on a daily basis breaks down and we have to get it repaired or repair it ourselves. But increasingly, when we go to do so with complicated electronic devices or the electronic devices masquerading as cars that we're driving around or things of that nature, we are being prevented from doing so, either because the right tools or the right parts are not available anywhere except through the manufacturer, or there are warranty restrictions on the type of repair work that can be done, or the schematics and repair manuals are being deliberately withheld from people who would otherwise be able to repair these types of things. There have been a number of blocks put in place between the people who want to repair their own equipment and their own hardware and their own software and their own cars, etc., and those objects themselves. blocks that have been put in place by the manufacturers, obviously to increase their bottom line. If a $20 wire or a $50 hose would be enough to fix this part on your motherboard or on your dishwasher or what have you, and if the manufacturer can make sure that you can't get that wire or that you can't install that hose yourself and you need a certified manufacturer, certified tech to do it, well, they can jack up the rates by thousands of percents. This is not rocket science. And I assume most people in the audience have at least heard of this problem and the movement that has grown to counter it, the right to repair movement. But having said that, there are some interesting questions that this raises, because the problem here is quite obvious. We all, as I say, we all understand it, but what is the solution? And today we are in Solutions Watch, so we are not concentrating on the problem itself. We're concentrating on what can be done about that problem, and that's where we start to run into some, well, interesting things that, well, may go against the principles of committed voluntarists like myself, but even more fundamentally, I think actually ultimately go against the best interest of the people who are advocating for this right to repair movement. What am I talking about? Well, let's look further down in this exact same article on right to repair, where we get into what is the right to repair. And the article informs us that at its core, the right to repair is both a legal concept and a social movement. Right there, that's an interesting distinction that's being made. And what does that mean? Well, the legal concept is that it is the right for owners of devices and equipment to freely modify and repair the products they have purchased. Okay, that sounds absolutely straightforward. And again, I can't imagine how anyone whose bottom line does not depend on blocking people from doing repairs could possibly be opposed to that. You buy it, you own it, you can break it open and repair it to your heart's content. Who would be against that, right? Okay. And the social movement side of it, this informs us, citizens and advocacy groups pressuring governments to enact laws that protect this right from manufacturer-imposed barriers. All right. Immediately, I think people in my long-term audience are going to start to understand why I might have some kind of misgiving about this framing of this particular movement, that it's a social movement that's organized around citizens and advocacy groups lobbying governments to try to enact laws that will somehow enshrine their right to repair in law. But it's, before you get all hoity-toity, well, James is being all stuffy about it. Well, what's wrong with a government passing a law if it's doing something good? I think there are some very, very big pitfalls that people will fall into when they start along that road of, hey guys, the way forward is to lobby the government to pass laws. We'll get into that more in more detail, but as this article goes on to say, the ultimate goal is to shift our economy from a replace culture to a repair culture, making fixes more affordable and accessible. This fosters sustainability and reduces waste. Absolutely. Again, who wouldn't be on board with those concepts? And these go around four essential pillars of repairability, which are not immediately intuitive if you've never really thought about this. First of all, being able to repair your own goods, it requires access to information like repair manuals, diagnostic information, and design schematics that manufacturers provide to their authorized dealers, but only their authorized dealers. Well, what about Joe Schmo or the repairman down the street or me? Can we get that same information? Well, sometimes you literally do need that information in order to perform repairs. So if you want a right to repair, then you're going to have access to that information. Access to parts and tools. Again, pretty straightforward. You need the parts and tools that are required in order to fix your device, whatever that may be. Freedom from software locks, because of course, again, as we've seen, there's a lot of digital rights content management systems that have been put in place for software to basically harbor and hold the secrets of whatever device that you're looking at. And if you are not allowed to legally break those software locks in order to go in and actually diagnose or fix a problem, then that's going to make you a criminal for trying to repair your device, which obviously goes against the right to repair. Repair-friendly design. So now we're starting to advocate, well, you know, you can't just make things that are designed to break down. You have to, if you do, they have to at least be easily fixable. But now we're starting to get into somewhat of a, I think, a judgment call. But anyway, case for repair, why advocates say this matters, talking about the circular economy and ownership argument, equity argument, etc., and some of the arguments that have been made against and some of the roadblocks and back and forth. This is a very, very lengthy and detailed article, so I will put it in the show notes for today's edition of the podcast at corporatereport.com/right to repair. If you want to go and read this and anything else that I'm citing today in greater detail, but we've seen what the problem is. And again, I think it's something that everyone in the audience, I would imagine, is broadly behind. Just the concept that, yes, if I own something, if I buy something, I should be able to take it home. And if it breaks, I should be able to open it up and fix it or get somebody to fix it for me. My choice, not a manufacturer imposed choice, right? Who could be against that? But how do we do that? And to the extent that the right to repair movement is just a bunch of people going around and going, oh, please, Mr. Government, please pass a law that will make these manufacturers do what we want, I think you're going to end up with a bad time. And don't take my word for it. Let's start getting into the brass tacks. Let's look at this particular, since we broached this particular problem, which is only one case in this broad range of right to repair cases that we could be looking at. But in the case of the automotive industry and the fight that is going on right now to have a right to repair, for example, your car, and why car dealers and manufacturers might be in the White House lobbying against that with Trump and what's going on there. Well, let's see what the online right to repair type people have said about this case.
Well, they said the quiet part out loud. The auto industry said that they don't want us fixing our cars, and Trump said he's going to do something about it. The Right to Repair Act. Got to make a bill for that. Where do we live? I thought we lived in the United States. Yeah, I wonder why they're pushing that for. Controlling money.
The Repair Act, which is going through Congress right now, which I think is great, would require that the automotive manufacturers provide independent mechanics access to what the dealers have so that they have access to the data that's in your car. You should be allowed to choose who gets the data that's on your car, not the manufacturer. I think it's a great act. The Repair Act is a good thing. You should email your congressional representative in the House and the Senate and tell them that you want to see this pass. And if it gets watered down in any way from its current form, even the tiniest bit of watering down, you are going to be voting for their challenger in the primary and their challenger in the general election. Seriously.
And I'm going to get a little passionate on this one. And again, it doesn't matter where you fall on the political spectrum. The one thing that's more powerful than lobbyists, because lobbyists spend a lot of money to get politicians to vote how they want them to vote. One thing that's more powerful than that is your vote. Is you getting out there and you doing something. Because if they're not in, they're not elected, then they don't get the lobbyists coming after them. They don't get the lobbyists handing them what they want to vote a certain way. That's my belief in that. That's about as political as you're ever going to get on this channel. But it's really making me see things here when we've got manufacturers that are actively trying to get you where you don't actually own your vehicle.
All right, gang, let's go. Right to repair. All we have to do is support the Repair Act. Well, that sounds simple enough, because as we know, if we just make sure that our elected representatives know that if they water down this right to repair bill, that we'll not vote for them, and that will influence the way that they treat this legislation that's passing through Actually, no, we know that that is absolute pie-in-the-sky, total fantasy nonsense, and I say that not just from my own perspective, but from the perspective of empirical study. Yes, you may have missed it, but in case you did, over a decade ago, even Cambridge University Press was publishing studies testing theories of American politics, elites, interest groups, and average citizens, which concluded that multivariate analysis indicates that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. Again, this isn't opinion. This is documentable statistical fact. And for people who have never read this study, I will throw in the link so you can go read the entire thing, including, of course, Table 4, which really puts it in the nutshell. American citizens' preferences has, as they say in the study, essentially zero impact on whether a piece of legislation gets passed or not, whereas economic elites' preferences has an overwhelmingly positive impact on whether something gets passed or not. So it doesn't matter what you think or what you tell your congressman. he better support this legislation, or he better not water it down, or whatever. So that's pie-in-the-sky fantasy nonsense and not a viable solution as far as I'm concerned. But let's give it the benefit of the doubt. Okay, the Repair Act. So all we got to do is support this Repair Act thing, make sure it clears through Congress, and bada bing, bada boom, we're going to be living in repair utopia, right? But actually, as I was sitting here researching today's episode and going down the rabbit hole, I thought, you know what? Actually, the going down the rabbit hole and trying to research this is actually part of the point. So let's do a little bit of this on air. Why not? So literally, the first thing that I come up with when I'm trying to find the actual link to whatever actual legislation is actually going through Congress, I find this repairer-driven news article, which seems very to the point, doesn't it? Repairer-driven news, this has got to be the straight talk on what's going on. So in May of this year, they had this article on U.S. House Committee approves amended Repair Act that backs 2014 MOU. And I've been around the block enough to know that MOU is Memorandum of Understanding. But what is the 2014 MOU? I'm not exactly sure. Well, I'm sure it'll all come clear in this article. Newly passed legislation by the U.S. House Committee on Energy and Commerce codifies the 2014 Memorandum of Understanding between auto manufacturers and the aftermarket to ensure repairers have access to repair information and tools, narrowing the focus of prior Right to Equitable and Professional Auto Industry Repair Act proposals. Repair Act proposals. So new legislation codifies a decade-old Memorandum of Understanding that narrows the focus of a prior Repair Act proposal. What? Don't worry, guys. It's all coming clear. H.R. 7389, the Motor Vehicle Modernization Act of 2026, includes several pieces of legislation regarding transportation safety, as well as the proposed Repair Act. And several facets of the Repair Act are essentially stripped in the amended act passed 48-1 by the committee on May 21. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? The Alliance for Automotive Innovation, Auto Innovators, emailed a statement to RDN about this legislation. The Repair Act that cleared the committee today is vastly different than earlier versions of the bill that we opposed. The committee essentially codified an existing memorandum of understanding established in 2014 between automakers, independent repairers, and aftermarket parts retailers, whereby automakers committed to making all repair instructions, tools, and diagnostic codes readily available to dealers and independent repairers. This is something we've been emphasizing for quite some time. What? Okay, so I'm not sure. Does this mean the Repair Act has been watered down, or it hasn't? Anyway, well, at the very least, we've got the actual link here, HR 7389, so we can click on that, open it up. Oh, there you go. There's the bill, so we can actually read through it. And yeah, it'll take a lot of due diligence to read through all of this and to figure out what's going on in it, but at least we know HR 7389, the Repair Act, right? Right? Well, maybe not. Let's on a lark. Let's just open up a new window here and just see. Repair Act. Wait, so when I type in Repair Act, the first thing that comes up is HR 1566. So what's going on here? This is the same act, or is it a different act? Well, if we read the text and we've got, oh no, it's HR 1566. Right, Repair Act, maintaining competition and data privacy after what? But this is the Motor Vehicle Modernization Act of 2000. What is going on here, guys?
Now, let's expose the shell game here. This is where it gets slippery, because these guys didn't just walk in there holding a sign that said ban repairs. That's not at all how any of this works. Now, there are two bills sitting in Congress right now. The Repair Act, that's the real one, and that would give you and your independent mechanic actual legal access to your car's data. Diagnostic data, telematics, all of it. Now, there'd be no restrictions, no manufacturer gatekeeping. The other bill is HR 7389. That's the Motor Vehicle Modernization Act. And Ford and GM and the Alliance for Automotive Innovation are all publicly backing that one, because it passed committee 48-1 in May. Now that sounds good, right? Well, here's the catch. The telematics provision, that's the part about your data. That's the part about you being able to control how you get information in and out of your truck, or car or changing it, that all got stripped out entirely. It's gone. The one thing that actually matters to independent repair shops, the one thing that would cost these companies the most, it's not in this bill. So they didn't go to Washington to kill repair. They went to Washington to make sure that the version of repair that passes is the version that they wrote. That's actually harder to fight because on paper, it looks like a win to so many people watching from the outside.
Oh goody, a shell game in which lobbyists are putting out fake legislation that's designed to water down other legislation that you're supposed to be for, unless that legislation gets watered down behind your back, so you better... Oh boy. All right, well, if you want to get into it, so that particular legislation that we're looking at from the Repairer-Driven News article is HR 7389, which is the Motor Vehicle Modernization Act of 2026, which is not the Repair Act, but looks and smells and tastes an awful lot like it. So what's the difference? Well, I am reliably informed, although full confession, I haven't read the complete text of both of these different versions of this legislation yet. But part of the key is in the magic of telematics. Telematics is the wireless system for transmitting the data that your car is collecting about you at all times, because, of course, our cars are basically surveillance tools at this point. And all of that data that it's collecting on you and your driving habits and all of that information about the systems and processes that are going on under the hood, or should I say on the motherboard, are available to the authorized dealers through these wireless systems through which they can access this data, but they are not available to others. And so should this data be available to everyone? Obviously, Right to Repair says, yes, this is an important part. In fact, this is the key part of Right to Repair for cars, is being able to access the data that your car has about you and about the car and about everything that's going on with the car. Without that, it's incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to solve a lot of automotive problems these days. So Right to Repair resolves around this telematics idea. And in this particular version of the Motor Vehicle Modernization Act, they have watered it down in the following way. In the section 204, they talk about a study on marketplace practices. The commission shall conduct a study under section 6B of the Federal Trade Commission Act that examines certain marketplace practices in the motor vehicle aftermarket, including the following: access to covered data over wireless technology via any telematic systems, blah, blah, blah. Also, the ability for a consumer to select any brand or manufacturer of parts, tools, or motor vehicle equipment, practices by motor vehicle manufacturers to limit the ability of an aftermarket parts manufacturer, motor vehicle equipment manufacturer, an aftermarket part manufacturer, or a motor vehicle repair facility from selling compatible aftermarket parts, blah, blah, blah. All the things that the Right to Repair people want have all been placed in the section 204, which, wait, let's go back to the top and reread that. Oh, study on practices. The commission shall conduct a study under Section 6B of the Federal Trade Commission Act. So they're going to, don't worry, guys. This is going to be shoveled off onto some marketplace practice commission, which is going to conduct some kind of study and decide whether or not these things are important. So that's, I think, the level of watering down that people are warning about. This modern Motor Vehicle Modernization Act is not a repair act. This is the watered down garbage that the automotive industry leaders were in the White House arguing for with Trump. They're not saying ban repairs. They're saying, no, pass this legislation, which is about motor vehicle modernization, and it's going to give people access to all this repair goodness. But they've watered it down by putting it into these section talking about forming a study group. Don't worry, guys. Whereas the actual Repair Act has telematics baked into the cake. With regard to a motor vehicle manufacturer shall, as in they have to, there's no study to be done here, to the extent such vehicle is equipped for wireless transmission of such data over wireless technology via any telematics. So they shall provide a motor vehicle owner without restriction or limitation the data about their car, etc. So this is the Repair Act, guys. This is the one that you guys should be making sure that your congressman is trying to pass, etc. Although this is the text from February 2025, so I'm not even sure this is the most up-to-date version of the bill. Again, to my American brothers and sisters, if you are the state-loving people who think that everything, all goodness flows from government and lobbying your congressman, I'm going to write my congressman about this, guys. Have at it. This is Solutions Watch. As you know, the remit of Solutions Watch is to throw stuff out at the wall and you decide what is going to work for you or not work for you, what you want to get, invest your time, your energy, resources, and attention on. And if you are motivated to be a campaigner and lobbying government and calling your congressman, you go out and you do that, guys, and let me know how that works. I am genuinely in your corner, genuinely hoping that you will get the big win that you're hoping for and that everything will be fixed. Personally, however, and this is my opinion, I think that's tosh and nonsense and the very trap that has been designed to keep you running around in the hamster wheel, having precisely zero effect on anything, because you are not in charge of the government. It is not a government by and for and of the people. Having said all of that, then, okay, so what is the answer here? This is Solutions Watch. What's your solution, James? Well, if we are not arriving at the right answer for what a solution could be, then obviously we've articulated some part of the problem incorrectly. We've got something wrong. There's something off in our analysis. So what can it be? Let's go back to examine the roots of the problem and see if we can identify something that we can actually take into our own hands and start taking responsibility for and working towards.
If I go into a bookstore and buy a book, I can confidently say I own it. I can do whatever I want with it. Read it, lend it, resell it. I can even take a power tool to it and turn it into a lamp. This is all thanks to a very old provision of copyright law called the First Sale Doctrine.
Once a copy is sold to a member of the public, the publisher or the rights holder no longer has control over that copy. That's how we have public libraries in the United States, for example. It's why we have used record stores and Goodwill.
The First Sale Doctrine draws a clear line between intellectual property and the personal property of consumers. But in the digital age, that line is becoming blurry. If I go to Amazon's ebook store, I'm clicking a button that says buy, and I'm paying them money. But according to Amazon, I didn't buy anything. I only licensed it. When you frame a transaction as licensing instead of selling, the consumer rights we get with the First Sale Doctrine don't apply anymore. Instead, those rights remain with, in this case, Amazon, who can put all sorts of restrictions on us. So, according to the contract I agreed to when I bought this book, I can only read this ebook using an Amazon-approved device if I have an active Amazon account. I can't loan it, make copies of it, or resell it. And Amazon will make extra sure I don't do any of those things by putting digital locks on their ebooks that would stop me if I tried. It's like renting a book with an invisible string that ties it to the seller. That invisible string is called Digital Rights Management, or DRM, and you'll find it on almost every digital product. Software, music, movies, books, video games. And if you figure out how to get around your ebook's DRM to lend it to a friend anyway, you'd be violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Wait, did you catch what she said there?
So, according to the contract I agreed to when I bought this book...
Oh, that's right. That's the fundamental level of this scam, is the fact that you don't buy your car or various items anymore. You don't buy a book online. No, you are licensing it. There are terms and conditions that stipulate your rights, not as a property owner, but as somebody who is licensing this or that from the company that is deigning to license it to you. And yes, it looks like a buy button. It says buy on it, but it doesn't really mean buy, at least not in that sense. You've got to read the micro dot on page 357 of the terms and conditions that you don't look at when you click agree, or that are buried somewhere else where you don't even get to see. So if that is the root of the problem, the fact that you don't really own that thing that you think you own, and thus you don't have the right to repair or whatever terms and stipulations the company decides to put on it, what are you going to do about it? It strikes me that there are two options. You can call your congressman and start a campaign to get an advocacy group to lobby governments and elected representatives to pass legislation to force companies to give you a buy button that actually lets you buy and not license it to you, unless you want that thing licensed to you, and then it should be up front and you should be able to understand, and that you should also have access to the right materials and repair tools and all of this. Or you could just actually choose to buy from companies that are actually going to sell to you in the way that you want. This is not, in my opinion, the second one seems a lot simpler and a lot more straightforward, but that's pie in the sky, James. Come on, that couldn't possibly work. There are no companies that do that anymore, and nor could there ever be, say the brainiacs in the crowd who want to continue banging their head against the brick wall of legislative lobbying. Well, I will counter with a real-life example, and not a trivial one either. Yes, we can all imagine some manufacturer of toasters or other minor household items that could just actually sell you the thing and say, hey, it's yours, you repair it as you will. But that's maybe the trivial side of this. No, let's tackle one of the hard issues. Let's tackle an incredibly big issue, namely John Deere. For people who have been following the right to repair space, you'll already know about this. Or for farmers, you'll already know about it. For other people in the crowd, you might not have any idea, but John Deere has become one of the focus points of the right to repair movement because that manufacturer of tractors and farming equipment is notorious and infamous for locking down their products in various ways so that you can't just fix it easily. You have to call out the John Deere repair authorized repair person, and you have to, in many cases, at the height of harvest season, you have to take one of your tractors out of service and get it sent to the dealer, and it'll take 4 to 6 weeks to find out that it was the radio that was broken and that's why it wouldn't start, but you couldn't tell that by yourself. All of these crazy, ridiculous stories about the ways that farmers' lives are being ruined and they're being put into debt because John Deere owns the tractor and they're just licensing it to you. It's essentially a computer at this point, and they hold all the software and all of the data. So this is a huge problem, and one that the right to repair movement is very familiar with, because here's a major, big time manufacturer. How could any upstart possibly compete with that and actually provide, say, a farmer with a real, just simple working tractor that can actually do just basic farming activities that doesn't require fancy computer equipment and that you can repair yourself if something goes wrong? How could that ever possibly happen?
At a time when modern machinery is becoming increasingly software-driven, dealer-controlled, and more difficult to repair, one Canadian company has taken a novel approach, building simple tractors designed to be worked on, understood, and owned by the people who use them. Today's guest is Doug Wilson, founder of Ursa Ag, a company that is getting attention far beyond the farming world. Doug, welcome. It is really, really good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And your story really hit a nerve with our readers. We wrote about you a couple of weeks ago. But for those who have not heard about you, let's start with just tell us a bit about Ursa Ag and the impetus behind it.
So Ursa Ag was started at the urging of one of my customers. He had bought a machine from us, a wheel loader. And he came to me very sort of concerned that he couldn't hand the farm down to his son because his son couldn't afford the tractors.
Wow.
And he wanted to solve this problem. He wanted to get a tractor that would work for their operation that wouldn't cost as much as the I believe it was New Holland tractors he had at the time. And I looked into the market and I said, I don't think there's a tractor out there that'll do this. And so him and I, we put our heads together and figured out how to do it, what it would need, what would make it work for him. And, it ended up working really well. He called me about a week ago to tell me that he loves the tractor. He told me he loves the tractor, and to that he was certainly open to potential buyers calling him for a review.
So the affordability is one piece of what you're sort of pioneering here, but another piece, and I think a big piece of what has struck a nerve with so many people who have heard about you, is that you're building something simpler that people can fix themselves, something that they own outright, that they can work on, and that they can fix themselves. So there's almost a piece of sort of, there's like a little trucker convoy energy going on there. And in terms right. of you sort of pushing back, it's like a rebellion against what you just described in terms of that software driven fractional ownership model. So talk a little bit about that. Is there a bigger idea behind what you're doing here?
It really is driven by wanting to make the tractor work for the customer. It does go right back to that original farmer who talked me into doing this in the first place. He didn't need a complicated transmission. He was perfectly happy pushing the clutch. Mm-hmm. He just needed that if a leak started, he could fix it. That's what he was looking for. If the engine needed work, he could do it, or at the very least, any mechanic could work on it. And I think that is an overwhelming feeling among the medium-sized farmer, is that they can't afford $200 an hour for a dealer truck to come out and fix their equipment. Mm-hmm. And that is universal. It's 200 here, it's 200 in the US. That amazed me when I started talking to guys in the US about their repair costs. The need is fairly clear, and the skill on the part of the farmers themselves has been there for years. Mm-hmm. They're very capable and very knowledgeable. They don't need to call tech support to fix things. Right. So they're only going to call tech support to fix things if they're forced to.
Exactly. So I should mention that you're not only based in Canada, you're in Alberta, Canada.
Correct.
And I just wanted to ask you, so how is business going? How long have you been offering these new tractors, and are you selling a lot of them, and to whom?
So we've been building tractors now for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. We were growing nicely. This year we made an arrangement to kind of double our production capacity. So we were already going to build quite a number of tractors this year compared to what we did, say, last year. But the notoriety we've gotten, the interest we've gotten from being pretty visible on social media has driven that a little faster and harder than we had planned. So right at this moment, our production's sold out through August.
And what is that production look like? How many tractors?
That's right around 20 tractors between okay. now and August. Might be a little more than 20, but it's about that. Mm-hmm. But the problem that we have right now is not that we couldn't build more. I could build 50 tractors between now and August. We have a supply chain lag because mm-hmm. I didn't plan for this kind of volume. So I don't have enough transmissions to build more than 20 tractors between now and the end of August.
But do you have a waiting list? Do you have that much interest that there would be people lined up?
Really? Yeah, we have a waiting list. We have deposits on tractors we're not going to deliver till August. Demand has exceeded my expectations by quite a bit, but it's been incredibly encouraging in the whole project for sure.
All right, hat tip over to Zara at Collapse Life for that clip from her podcast. I hope you remember that podcast because I was a guest on it in the past. But there is Zara Sethna of Collapse Life talking to Doug Wilson of Ursa Ag. And hat tip to Doug for doing what he is doing. And you can find out more about what Doug is doing at ursa-ag.com. The link will be in the show notes along with everything else we've talked about today. But here's the homepage and what it looks like. Built Alberta tough, priced right, no frills, back to basics, built to last. And our tractors are built without computer controls by design. The intentional simplicity delivers reliability. And they've got several different models that are available here. Although, as he indicated in that podcast from last month, they're booked through up to August in terms of delivery. So probably even further than that by this point. So, but anyway, you can go and look into it and look into the specs. And certainly for any, that Venn diagram overlap of farmers who listen to the Korber Report, this might be up your alley. And I hope you would at least Take a look at it. And if you're not in the market yourself, maybe pass the word along to other farmers that you know who are in the market for a tractor that you can actually just fix and repair and use yourself and that will not break the bank. Now, obviously, of course, the big caveat, well, obviously, if you're some multi-billion dollar farming conglomerate behemoth that's running these $1 million tractors, etc., this probably isn't going to replace that, at least not yet and not right away. But at the very least, this, to me, is a much better indication of the direction that we should be going here. Not, oh, Mr. Government, won't you please pass some kind of law to make John Deere do what I want them to do? No. Take the money away from John Deere and give it to someone who is going to sell you what you want. What a remarkable idea. Actually holding the companies accountable and hurting them where it counts when they treat you like garbage. I think that is a much more effective way to get our point across, and it is going to hurt. I am not saying this is the path to utopia and nirvana and it'll all work out and no problems possible here, guys. Of course, it will be a painful transition as we start to wean ourselves off of the Amazons and John Deere's and Fords of the world and start supporting the little upstarts, the little guys that could, who are out there trying to create things that people can just use and repair to their heart's content. That, to me, seems like the way forward. But as always, I'm interested in your take as well. So if you are a Corbett Report paid up member, please log into the website and go to corbettreport.com/right-to-repair, where you can leave your thoughts on this topic. It's an incredibly important one, one that I'm sure we'll be circling back to in the future. So I'm looking forward to your commentary on that. But in the meantime and in between time, this is James Corbett of corbettreport.com. Thank you for investing your time in today's important exploration. I look forward to talking to you again in the near future. The Corbett Report is 100% listener supported. Join the Corbett Report community to become a member and log into corbettreport.com to read the subscriber newsletter featuring my weekly editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report merchandise, and once a month, a subscriber exclusive video. Sign up today at corbettreport.com/members and help support this independent media.